Tony Gallo had not been entirely truthful. He had actually been back in New Zealand for almost 5 weeks. And although he would never have confessed it, he had observed Shelley from a distance twice already, though without recalling that they had ever met. On both occasions, she had been with Mira. On the first, cycling together through the teacher training college campus, Shelley grinning broadly while Mira, who was riding one-handed, gesticulated wildly to accompany a joke. And on the second, sorting through refuse behind the junk shop that adjoined the tip, where, before Tony's departure, Mira had worked on Saturday mornings, and where he had gone the first Saturday after he had seen her cycling, in the hope that her schedule hadn't altered in the years that he had been away. Evidently it had not. But as he turned into the car park and was preparing to cut the engine and get out of the car, he saw that Mira was again occupied in conversation, this time gravely, nodding along with solemn emphasis while Shelley spoke. None of Tony's rehearsals for the scene of their reunion had allowed for the presence of a third party, and to see her so engrossed in whatever it was that Shelley was saying made him abruptly lose his nerve, as if her complete absorption in the present moment proved, in itself, how little she now thought of him, and how seldom she had recourse to the past. She was dressed, as Shelley was, in a boiler suit and regulation steel-capped boots, and as he sat in the idling car with his hand on the ignition, Tony felt suddenly acutely conscious of his own freshly laundered clothes, which smelled of the eucalyptus fabric softener used by his mother that, of all the scents of his childhood, held the strongest associations for him of being home. Seconds later, something Shelley said caused Mira to throw her head back and laugh. And almost as a reflex, Tony reversed out of his parking spot, jammed the gear stick into first, and drove away, hunching unnaturally low over the steering wheel and praying that she would not look over and recognize the receding license plate of his father's car. His appearance at the flat that afternoon had been more carefully curated, from the clothes that he was wearing and the mode of his arrival, right down to the contents of his backpack, which included his journal, his fountain pen, a vintage 35mm camera, and several books that he had already read. He had come by bus, intending to arrive a little after 4, a respectable hour for a social visit, and still early enough in the day that if there was nobody at home, he could sit on the doorstep and read for a while without it seeming as if he meant to ambush her. True, he had not called ahead. But this was in keeping with a challenge he and Mira had once set themselves to communicate as much as possible off-grid. And anyway, the contract on his old New Zealand phone had lapsed, and in switching to a new provider, he had lost everybody's numbers. All these mental preparations now felt rather foolish. As he waited in the yard for Shelley to collect her things and lock up the house, he looked around him at all the signs of industry and productivity, and was again overpowered by a gloomy sense of his own redundancy in Mira's life. It was clear that Burnham Wood had flourished in his absence, which itself was bittersweet. And although he had prepared himself, resolutely, for the likelihood that Mira would be in a relationship, and possibly a very serious relationship, now it struck him that to learn that she was single might feel weirdly even worse. Tony's homecoming had been unexpectedly dispiriting. He was sensitive to condescension, and had detected in his siblings a kind of provincial triumph that the terms of his visa had at last obliged him to return. He felt himself admonished, as he had just remarked to Shelley, both by the fact that everything was different, and by the fact that everything had stayed the same. His younger brother and his father had become very close in his absence, but in a way that seemed exaggerated for his benefit, as though to make a point of all the many intimacies he had missed. The pieties of his sisters he now found almost too much to bear, and his mother's complacency in the face of his father's patent scorn for her enraged him. He was hurt by their apparent lack of curiosity in his adventures overseas, and angered by his own regression back to sulky adolescence, which had been almost instantaneous, and which felt disturbingly out of his control. This, in fact, was the main reason that he had not called on Mira any sooner. He had spent much of the past 5 weeks in a cycle of fury and impotent resentment that he knew was deeply unattractive, and that he did not feel that he could trust himself to hide. Tony was the middle child of 5, and the exception, as he saw it, to the family rule, which, unusually in New Zealand, was devoutly Catholic, conservative, and very strict. All of his siblings had followed the example set by his father, his sisters into medicine, his father's profession, and his younger brother into the seminary, his father's boyhood dream. This road not taken was of great significance to Dr. Gallo's personal mythology, and by extension, the family mythology, which he controlled. A failed celibate, he regarded the existence of his wife and children with disappointment and profound regret. His own father, Tony's Grandpa Gallo, had been an envoy to the Holy See, and was so large a figure in the family lore that as a child, Tony had confused him with the Pope, boasting to his neighbor's children that his grandpa was the guardian of the keys to heaven, which a half-grasped Easter Sunday homily had convinced him were not metaphorical but real. When Tony's father heard this, he responded by docking Tony's pocket money for a month. Dr. Gallo's preferred mode of discipline was to impose arbitrary sanctions on his children for specified periods of time. He kept a calendar on the fridge devoted to the purpose of recording which child had been banned from what luxury and for how long. Pocket money, but also television, the computer, rainy day school pickups, the trampoline, pudding, bedtime cocoa, playing in the common spaces and snacking between meals. Of all the children, it was Tony who was most often sentenced. As the eldest son and the third child, he bore the brunt of both his father's expectations and his father's impatience. And as a result, his moral conscience had been shaped, from as far back as he could remember, by a vivid sense of his own damnation and a bitter yearning that punishment, for once, should be made to fit the crime. Inevitably, the first great rebellion of Tony's adolescence had been to renounce his faith. He was a bright boy, prideful of his intellect, critical often to the point of indignation, and observant of hypocrisy, especially, he insisted, in himself. And while he could accept that there was more than a touch of petulance in his decision to stop attending Mass, he made an exception for funerals and weddings, but refused to take communion, genuflect, or sing. He was careful to subject his atheism to the same doubts and provocations with which he had once challenged his belief. Intellectual rigor was the habit he most admired in others, especially when combined with an inclination to debate. And he found it not among his siblings or his schoolmates, but online, chatting with strangers on the badly formatted discussion boards that just predated Twitter and Facebook, where conversation was impermanent and anonymity was guaranteed. As his rhetoric and reading life matured, he grew intensely scornful of what passed at his high school for education, the mania for testing, the intolerance of real dissentment, and the conformist celebration of the honed and polished all-rounder student destined for high income, who was deferent and well-spoken, invariably good-looking, and proficient in music as well as in one summer and one winter sport. He neglected his schoolwork as a form of protest and surprised his parents every year when he earned top marks on his exams. At university, he majored in political philosophy and gained a reputation for being adversarial in seminars, to the point that he was often asked, in the language of the day, to check his privilege. Most often, it seemed to him, at the very moment that his opponent's other, better arguments ran out. Politics, as the adage goes, is first experienced at home, and the autocratic Dr. Gallo had ruled his household in a manner that was so oppressive and so patently unjust that Tony had grown used to thinking of himself in insurrectionary terms. All his life he'd been overlooked, subjugated, ridiculed, and deprived of opportunities for self-defense, and he would not be persuaded now that his sole emancipation from Dr. Gallo's tyranny, his mind, was merely a symptom representing him as yet another tool of the oppressor class. It was a sentiment not of victimhood exactly, for he was too proud to indulge the term, but of an open license to rebel. His intellect was his liberty, and he knew no greater provocation than to have his vocabulary or his style of rhetoric policed. He had followed his bachelor's degree with a master's critiquing the anti-humanism of post-structuralist political thought, by which point he felt that he had reached the limit of what a remote, sparsely populated, historically benign island nation could offer him. 2 days before his graduation, Grandpa Gallo died, leaving an estate that was far larger and more lucrative than anybody in the family had imagined. And the first thing Tony bought, once everything had been settled and all the legacies dispersed, was a ticket overseas. Shelley came out of the house, wearing a down jacket and carrying a small backpack of her own, and he arranged his face into an expression of polite expectancy as she locked the deadbolt and pocketed her keys. "All good," she said, smiling at him. He smiled back and indicated with his open hand that she should lead the way. It troubled him that he could not remember who she was. Tony considered himself to have a healthy respect for women. Healthy, that is, because it was not entirely unconditional. He in no way opposed the fundamental aims of feminism, and indeed would have welcomed, he felt sure, any well-argued point in its favor. But over the course of his 20s, he had found himself increasingly at odds with the prevailing orthodoxies of the contemporary feminist left, which seemed to him to have abandoned the worthy goal of equality between the sexes in pursuit of either naked self-interest or revenge. He could not accept a worldview whose terms he was not allowed to question, and he resented the caricature of power and entitlement that he was forever being told that he embodied, automatically and absolutely, no matter what his intentions were, and no matter what he felt or thought, or even did. But he could not deny now that in forgetting Shelley Noakes, and he really did not remember her at all, he conformed, or at least had once conformed, to this very picture, and the knowledge rattled him. He felt, obscurely, as though he had been led into a trap, not by Shelley, but by all the women who had accused him, without basis, of sexism in the past. "Was it a good program?" Shelley asked, as they set off down the driveway together. "Were you teaching? Would you recommend it? Was it a good deal?"
"Keen to go yourself?"
"Maybe," Shelley said, sounding as if the answer surprised her. "Maybe, yeah."
"I could definitely help you out," Tony said. "I mean, if you're serious. There are heaps of people I could put you in touch with."
"Bit dangerous, when you don't know who the hell I am."
"Well, I doubt you're an axe murderer. I don't quite get that vibe."
She considered his remark. "Why do we always say axe murderer, but we never say gun murderer or knife murderer?
Or chainsaw murderer?"
"No, you would definitely say chainsaw murderer."
"Would you?"
"Definitely," she said. "That's key information. Can't sit on that."
"But wouldn't you say, like, she was a murderer and she used a chainsaw?"
"Hey," Shelley said, "why she?
Aren't you the example here?"
"Okay," she said. "Then it'd be chainsaw murderess. That's what they'd call me, the chainsaw murderess."
"Sounds like a band."
"That's what everybody says, right before I cut their faces off." Tony laughed.
"Well," he said, "we really are getting to know each other."
They walked on in silence for several paces. "Tell me about it, though," she said presently. "You were teaching English. What level? What kind of students were they? How old? Was it through a charity? What was it like?" These were the questions Tony's family had never asked, that he had longed for them to ask. And as he began to answer, describing his experience in Mexico City, his teaching life, his colleagues, the essays he had published, the protest marches he had attended, and the friends he had made, he felt for the first time since his return a genuine pleasure and contentment. It was almost a surprise to remember that he could be proud, that he was proud of all that he had seen and done abroad, and to feel himself distinguished by the habituated worldliness that since his homecoming had seemed to mark him only as a deserter, a tiresome condescender, and an apostate, not just of his religion, but of his family, his country, and even, in some impenetrable way, of himself. Shelley was not well-travelled, but she expressed no envy or impatience when he told her about backpacking through Guatemala, Honduras and Nicaragua, Brazil and Venezuela, Ecuador, Chile and Peru, instead asking him with unfeigned curiosity about the food, the local customs, what differences he had observed between the countries, whether his preconceptions had been challenged, and whether he felt changed. She was a good listener, inquisitive, empathetic, generous with her attention, and associative in her replies. And they had been talking for almost 20 minutes before the conversation turned to her. Whereupon Tony was surprised again, and gratified again, to discover what a great deal they had in common. It turned out that they had both tutored high school English as undergraduates, had both found their schooling underwhelming, felt similar exasperations with the state of public discourse in New Zealand, and shared a love of John Wyndham and Ursula Le Guin. Politically, Shelley was the outlier in her family, as Tony was, and she confessed that this had been a source of some sadness during her years at Burnham Wood, since most of the members had inherited their politics from their parents and could not understand the loneliness, even the sorrow, in having forged a path alone, an achievement that deserved some commendation, Shelley felt.
She had read online somewhere that one's parents' voting preference was by far the most accurate predictor of one's own political alignment, way more than age, ethnicity, gender, educational attainment, or locale. Tony was very pleased by the statistic, which she had not heard before, and as they swapped tales of their mutual disenchantment, he felt more and more astonished that he could ever have forgotten someone so thoroughly simpatico as Shelley Noakes. It never crossed his mind that since she had not forgotten him, the personality that she revealed to him might very easily have been customized, the opinions tailored, the resume adapted, to suit what she remembered of his interests and his taste. Never dreaming that she might be flirting with him, he reflected only that there was something appealingly familiar in her candid warmth and air of frank and ready capability, qualities of a certain type of Kiwi woman that until that moment he had not realized he had missed. "Whenever I did anything with Burnham Wood," he said, "like even if I just mentioned it, even just said the name, my dad would say, without fail, 'So who's Macbeth?' It was his one joke."
"You should have said, 'Actually, Dad, you are,'" Shelley said.
"Exactly," Tony said. "Only I think that's kind of what he wanted me to say."
"My dad used to call it Burnham Woulda Coulda Shoulda," Shelley said. Tony burst out laughing.
"Oh my God," he said, "brutal.
Just if that makes you feel any better."
"You know," Tony said, still laughing, "it kind of does."
They'd arrived at the bar. "My shout," Shelley said as she opened the door. "Only fair. I am about to kill you, after all."
"Well, thanks," he said. "Beer would be great. Whatever ale they've got on tap. Monteith's."
He went to find a table, now feeling quite cheerful, and thinking that perhaps it had been a stroke of luck that Mira hadn't been at home when he had called. The last time they had spoken had been at his leaving party almost 4 years ago, a night that hung in his memory as a dozen dimly lighted moments threaded on a string. Mira on the dance floor, turning her hands in the air above her head. Mira flushed on the fire escape, her eyes closed, pressing the globe of her wine glass hard against her cheek. Mira with an avid look. Mira with her hand around his wrist. The next morning, in the forlorn self-pity of a severe hangover, he had composed a long and tormented email to her that had sat on his desktop for 6 weeks, before, drunk again, he had dragged it to the bin and deleted it forever. And that was that. They had had no contact since. In 4 years, no messages, no emails, no calls. He had no idea whether she had composed and deleted any comparable messages to him. No idea whether she had missed him. No idea how she would receive him, what she would think of him, what she would say. But now, he thought happily, as he unwound his scarf and unbuttoned his coat, now, thanks to Shelley, he had the means of finding out. Now, when he and Mira reunited, he would be forearmed. Shelley set down a pitcher of honey-coloured ale and two glasses. "Happy hour," she said.
"Awesome," Tony said. "Thanks heaps."
He watched her pour and then said,
"So you stuck with it all this time?"
"You mean with Burnham Wood?"
"Yeah, just that's a big commitment is all. You must be pretty hardcore."
She handed him his beer and began to pour her own. "It's changed quite a bit since you left," she said, seeming to be choosing her words with care. "You might be disappointed."
"How do you mean?"
"More mainstream, I guess," she said. "Not as many anarchists. Do you remember the crust punks? Dan Javins and what's his name? Fink?"
"Oh my God, Fink!"
"Yeah," said Shelley. "They're long gone."
"That's me out then," he said, feigning disappointment. "I was all set to come back, but if the crust punks are gone, fuck that."
She smiled at him. "It's just become a bit more of a business, is what I mean. Still non-profit and direct action and all of that, just more above board, more bureaucratic."
"You sound like you're over it."
"I just feel older, you know?" He waited for her to elaborate, but she glanced away, her attention caught by an advertisement on the television above the bar. He took a gulp of beer, watching her. After a moment, he said,
"What does Mira think about all that?"
"Oh," she said, "you know, still wants to take over the world.
No change there, then. Oh, Shelley said again, looking into her glass. I don't know. Maybe. She sipped her beer, suddenly remote. But when she put her glass back down on the table, she seemed to rouse herself and smiled at him again. So, obvious question. What are you going to do, now that you're back?
Freelance is the plan, he said. Essays, articles, whatever I can think up. Maybe a podcast.
Like journalism?
Yeah. Long-form investigative stuff, social commentary, a bit of theory. Not that personal essay travelogue shit. Stuff that actually takes a stand, you know, that actually demands a bit of time and attention. Not those fucking, what's the word, hot takes?
Spit takes.
Here's my spit take of your latest hot take.
Reckons, Shelley said. That's the word here.
No. Really?
Yeah, like, here's my reckon on mass incarceration.
Total endorsement?
See, you got it. That's a reckon.
Mass incarceration, not nearly mass enough?
Boom, she said. It writes itself.
Nah, he said. We shouldn't even joke about that, eh?
They were both quiet.
That's the plan anyway, said Tony, resuming the thread. Investigative journalism. I've got a website, and I've had a few things in journals and magazines and stuff. Nothing huge, but it's all about building up the profile in the beginning.
I feel bad, said Shelley. I never even knew that you were published.
Only online, he said. And it's all pretty niche. I've never been paid or anything.
Hey, man, she said lightly. Look who you're talking to. She was grinning, but he had a guilty feeling and ducked his face into his glass. He was embarrassed to have mentioned money. The Gallows had always kept a frugal household, and it hadn't been until Tony went abroad that he realized that what he had always taken to be middle class was really, by any global standard, rich. The revelation had produced in him not relief or gratitude, but a new and deeply unpleasant sense of his own complicity. For Grandpa Gallows' legacy, a fortune he had never known existed, let alone expected to receive, had left him suddenly much wealthier than any of his friends. He had never mentioned the bequest to anyone. Instead, he practiced inconspicuous consumption and began to cultivate a shabby hand-me-down appearance as a way of implying to everyone around him that, like them, he was only barely scraping by. It was partly to atone for his deception, and partly in continuation of it, that he had turned to journalism. Having pretended for so long that the asceticism of his lifestyle was a sacrifice he had no other option but to make, he now felt an almost desperate desire to earn an income from his writing, and thereby prove, in concrete terms, that his life's project, the expansion of his mind, was more than what he feared it might be, merely a form of inauthentic tourism financed, hypothetically, by those very social and economic structures that he claimed so energetically to oppose. Despite the depth of his ambition, however, a part of him was relieved that Shelley had not heard about his online publications, for his debut, an experimental travelogue of the very sort that he had just announced to her, had provoked an outrage so comprehensively humiliating to him that he blushed to remember it. Nearly 4 years later, he still anxiously self-Googled on an almost daily basis, knowing, even as he did so, that by his frequent searches, he was helping Google's algorithm, in however small a way, to make the very connections he most wanted the search engine to forget. The offending piece had long since been taken down, but he could not erase the furious responses, the majority of which he could now quote by heart. The criticisms felt indelible, and he felt sure, he knew, with a hideous, sickening certainty, that it was only a matter of time before news of his disgrace would surface and make its way back home. The essay, which was titled In the Bronze, had begun with what Tony had thought was an illuminating anecdote from his first day in Mexico City. A scheduling confusion at the airport had meant that he was assigned a driver at the airport who spoke no English, and drove not a taxi, but his own private car. His name was Eduardo, and he was the cousin, Tony found out later, of the administrator at the English language school where Tony was to teach. For reasons obscure to Tony, they had been obliged to make a detour through a slum. Bronze, Eduardo kept saying, gesturing about. Bronze, bronze.
which Tony had taken to be a local form of slang he didn't know. As he was looking around him to try and decipher the meaning of the word from the context, he witnessed, from the safety of his vehicle, a fight between two young men that, as he later wrote, was the most confronting display of violence he'd ever seen firsthand. Later, with the help of a third-party translator, he learned that the word was actually Bronx. Eduardo had been trying to warn him that the neighborhood was dangerous. Using what he evidently assumed was a common reference to a place afflicted by poverty and crime, the essay had developed from there to meditate more generally on language barriers, class difference, Tony's philosophy of teaching, and his first impressions of living in a foreign place. But to his detractors, the damage had already been done. A doctoral student in cultural studies, San Diego, was the first to tweet a link to the essay, writing, "I can't even deal with how much is wrong here," and adding a trigger warning and the hashtags hashtag white privilege, hashtag poverty tourism, and hashtag yuck. The fury spread from there. Tony's name was trending in a matter of hours, and the more attention his essay attracted, the angrier his critics seemed to get. He was accused of colonialist condescension, of reinforcing harmful stereotypes, of sentimentalizing violence, and of being yet another entitled white man presuming, in a way that somehow managed to be both predatory and insipid, that the most valuable aspect of a thing was always, and only ever, his experience of it. Disgusted tweeters demanded to know why, if Tony had traveled to Mexico in order to teach English, he had not learned Spanish before he arrived. They pointed out all the invidious ways in which his essay implied the inarticulacy of his native guide, as though it were Eduardo's failure that Tony could not understand him. They asked what right he had to appropriate the fight that he had witnessed, to instrumentalize it, and to seek to profit from it in the form of cultural cachet. They analyzed the inherent problematics of his rather florid prose style, and they invited him, in less than cordial terms, to apologize to Mexicans, renounce all forms of white supremacy, and go home. To Tony's great surprise, he found himself now narrating all of this to Shelley. He had never spoken of the episode before, to anyone. Even at the time, he had experienced the fallout almost entirely alone. But he was warmed by the ale, and encouraged by Shelley's easy familiarity and natural good humour. And for once, he did not fear he would be judged. He knew, he confessed to her, that he had been absolutely in the wrong. He realized now that his essay had been hopelessly misguided, stupid, ignorant, and ill-conceived. But it had not escaped his notice that the most vocal of his critics were not Mexicans, but American graduate students, the vast majority of whom were white. People, in other words, who were a lot more like him than like Eduardo, and even less like the youths he'd seen fighting from the car. And surely his remorse was worth something. He had accepted his error, withdrawn the piece, sworn that he would never write in such a way again. Surely that meant something. And even if it didn't, even if the offense he'd caused was irredeemable by anything that he could do, or say, or even swear in reparation, surely the whole point of mercy was that it didn't have to be deserved. The pitcher was now empty.
"My round," Tony said. "And we're talking about me too much."
"It's fine," Shelley said, touching his arm. "It's interesting." At the bar, he ordered another pitcher of ale and a bowl of fries, reflecting with appreciation that Shelley was not one of those tedious women who counted carbohydrates and made a show of regulating what they ate and drank. It was only just after 6, still happy hour, but he was starting to feel quite pleasantly buzzed. And as he tapped his pin into the credit card machine, it occurred to him that Mira would be getting home quite soon. Perhaps, he thought, in beery complacency, he might suggest that she join them for dinner.
"How's she doing, anyway?" he said after he'd returned to the table and refilled their glasses. "Mira."
Shelley didn't answer at once. Then she said carefully, "I wouldn't want to answer for her."
"No, I meant from your point of view. Like, how's she getting on?"
"She's good," Shelley said. "She's doing good."
"Yeah?"
"I mean, so much has happened, you know. It's like, where do you start?"
"Yeah," Tony said, "completely."
He took a long pull from his glass, wanting to ask if Mira was seeing someone, but lacking the courage.
"I don't know how much she told you," he said and stared, and then immediately regretted it. Shelley glanced at him, but said nothing, waiting for him to go on. When he didn't, she said,
"You mean about your leaving party?"
"Okay," Tony said, making a comical wince. "So, you know." Another pause. Then Shelley said,
"Well, it was a long time ago."
"Yeah."
"And she was pretty drunk."
"Yeah," said Tony, too quickly, wincing again. Shelley seemed much stiffer and colder than she had before he had got up to go to the bar. Wondering where their affinity had gone, he remembered, suddenly, and with a spike of guilt, that she had also been in attendance at his leaving party. He had probably hurt her feelings by reminding her that he had not remembered who she was.
"Well," he said to excuse himself, "we were all pretty drunk that night."
She was watching his expression closely. "That was a different time, eh? Even just 4 years ago. But it was a different age."
"Completely," Tony said again, not quite sure what she meant, but relieved to have an opportunity to agree with her.
He took another gulp of beer to cover his embarrassment and cast his gaze around the room, cursing his clumsiness and wishing he had introduced the subject in a different way. She was still looking at him. He could see her in his peripheral vision. So he sucked his cheeks between his teeth and shook his head regretfully, as though to suggest that the issue was far too complex for ordinary conversation. He found he couldn't meet her gaze. Even though he had been fishing for it, he was hurt to learn that Shelley knew. Of course people talked, and they had been so young. Sexual gossip was considered common property back then, especially at Burnham Wood. Where their assemblies had a reckless, proselytizing energy, and they all competed to perform their lack of inhibition and to prove their deviation from the status quo. No piece of information held a higher value in those days than the confession of a one-night stand. They had all been obsessed, Tony included, with each other's dalliances and conquests, endlessly comparing the grossest, the wildest, the most confounding, the most regrettable, the best. Had he really expected Mira to be any different? But he had. He recalled that night again, her expression, solemn and determined, when, without warning or pretext, she put down her glass and cut him off mid-sentence by calmly taking hold of his wrist. Her look was open, avid, grave, even frightened. And she said nothing, just pulled on his wrist with a firm and level pressure that made her meaning absolutely clear. He hadn't said anything at all. Hadn't asked her where they were going, hadn't made a joke or made a sound or said her name. He had simply allowed her to lead him out of the house and down to the dewy slope at the bottom of the garden, where she had kissed him, kneeling on the grass. Shelley was still watching him. At last she said, "It's just like your essay, I guess." He glanced at her, frowning.
"What do you mean?"
Just that there was a time when publishing something like that would have been totally normal. Not that that was right, she added quickly. I mean, in so many ways it's a good thing that we don't tolerate that stuff anymore, that people are calling out injustice and holding power to account. But I also feel a certain, I mean, look at my own life. Like on social media, when I first got a Facebook account, I was just posting all sorts of shit. You know, just shit. Ignorant, self-serving stuff that I would never dream of posting now. Some of the stuff I said, when I remember it, ugh, it makes me feel sick. Not because it was hateful, not at all. Just because it was so blatantly out of touch, you know? Not with back then, but with right now. So yeah, I mean, while it's a good thing that people in power can't get away with stuff so easily anymore, myself included, absolutely, still, it's like the expectations were so different, even 4 years ago. It was a different time.
Wait, he said, still not quite following. I don't get the connection. What's just like my essay?
She stared at him. I mean, she said, she was pretty drunk. A group of businessmen in the far corner of the bar erupted into laughter at a joke. On instinct, Tony turned his face towards the noise, but he hardly heard them. His face felt tight all of a sudden, as if his head had filled with blood. When he found his voice, he said,
"Is that what she said about it?"
You really don't have to worry, Shelley said quickly.
I didn't, Tony said. Until right now.
She looked confused. But...
But what?
You never called her, Shelley said. And you never wrote or stayed in touch. I mean, it kind of seemed...
She never called me either, Tony burst out, cutting over her. And I was on a plane the next day. I was gone. It was my fucking leaving party. She knew I was leaving. She could have called to say goodbye, but she didn't, and neither did I. And she came on to me, by the way. I don't know what she told you, but she came on to me.
The evening was ruined, and the pitcher was still 3/4 full. He remembered suddenly, with a spike of fury, that he had ordered fries. Honestly, Tony, Shelley said, his name sounding foreign in her mouth. She barely talked about it, honestly.
Except to tell you she was really, really drunk.
She didn't have to tell me, Shelley said with a nervous giggle that sent a spear of anger into Tony's gut. She spent the whole next day throwing up. She threw up so much she gave herself 2 black eyes, both eyes. It was horrific. In a voice that Tony hardly recognized, he said,
So I gave her 2 black eyes?
She looked horrified. No, she said, drawing back. No way, I didn't say that. Tony was aware of a ringing in his ears, a sense of monstrous unreality. In his mind, the memory of the kiss dissolved, and he saw them fucking on the grass, still quiet, the only sound the broken rhythm of their breath. He saw Mira's look of aching openness, searching his expression even as they moved. He felt her start to tremble, an uncontrolled vibration in her pelvis as she gripped him with her legs and held him there. He heard the sudden swell of music as someone opened the door and called out Mira's name. And he saw her reaching up to press her forefinger against his lips, still staring at him, before she slipped out from underneath him, got up, and went quietly inside. Hey, Shelley said, putting up both hands. What's happening?
I have no idea, Tony said.
Shelley's phone was buzzing. She shifted her body to muffle the sound. Come on, we've all made mistakes, she said. You were young. You hooked up. It's nothing. Her phone buzzed again.
Are you going to get that? Tony said coldly.
No, she said. Look, you honestly don't have to worry. It's not like she ever mentioned it again. I was just a stupid...
It might be important, Tony said.
Miserably, Shelley fished out her phone and unlocked the screen. He watched as she scrolled through the messages.
Everything okay? He said after a few seconds.
Yeah, Shelley said. It's Mira. He noticed she was blushing.
What does she want?
Nothing, she said. It's fine.
Well, what does she say?
Tony knew that he was being rude, but it was costing him considerable self-restraint not to reach over the table and rip the phone out of her hand. Just Burnham Wood stuff, Shelley said, still not looking at him. She's heading out of town. New planting site, maybe.
Where?
She didn't answer him at once. She seemed to be battling with something, perhaps deciding how, or whether, to respond to Mira's messages. Eventually, reluctantly, she shut off the screen and put the phone back in her pocket. Did you hear about that landslide? She said. On the Korowai Pass?